focus on the Mahalich of the Kuzari. If you take a look, the Kuzari can be found on your source sheets on page, starting on the bottom of page 12. Bottom of page 12. And we're going to focus on the Mahalich of the Kuzari, because Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is certainly one of the thinkers that spends a great deal of time discussing the Bechiras Yisrael, what it means and why, and his thinking on this topic has had a humongous effect in terms of the machshava of Klal Yisrael on this important topic. And also, because as we'll see, I believe his perspective is not so clear, so we're going to try to read through some of it together and see if we can understand what he's getting at. I'll introduce the topic with an interesting letter I got a number of years ago. When you're on the YU Torah, you get all sorts of interesting letters from people all over the world. So this is what it said. Dear Kavod HaRabbi, Shalom Uvrachot. I'm Alberto Bencion Rodriguez. I'm a convert and live in Brazil. Learning together the Sefer HaKuzari, the great work of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, Zatzal, and we arrived on a critical point just on the first part of the book. Speaking generally there, Rabbi Yehuda presents clearly the doctrine of the inherent superiority of the Jew over the non-Jew, and he goes on, it was actually like a 10-page later, I think. But anyway, it goes on to describe, it was a very thoughtful letter, someone who read the Sefer very carefully and was bothered by essentially the racist, that was his words, theory of the Kuzari, of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. So, I don't know if we're going to be able to answer his question, but what we need to do is spend a little bit of time studying the Kuzari and try to understand his perspective. So first, a little bit of background. Rabbi Yehuda ben Shmuel Halevi was born in 1075 in Toledo, in Spain. In his youth, he studied under the Rif. He was a friend of the Rima Gash. He became a great poet. He moved to Granada to be close to Rav Moshe ibn Ezra. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi studied medicine, which provided him with a livelihood. He married and he had one daughter, who, according to legend, married the Rabbi Avram ibn Ezra. Besides the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote a number of poems, both secular poetry, including love poems, though they might perhaps be spiritual as well as many, many odes expressing his incredible love of Eretz Yisrael. We're aware of his famous kina, his famous kinos. And again, legend has it that he did eventually make it to Eretz Yisrael, and he knelt down to kiss the stones of Eretz Yisrael and proclaim Tzion Halo Tishali, his famous kina that we read on Tisha B'Av, and at that time he was trampled by an Arab horseman. That tragic story is cited by Gedalia ibn Yahya in Shalshalas HaKabbalah. Now, the most important work that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote is what we call the Sefer HaKuzari. It was written in Arabic, Kitab al-Kazari, I think. I think the literal translation of the title is The Book of Argument and Proof and Defense of the Despised Faith. And the story behind the Kuzari is a story that reached Spain in the 10th century, so before the Kuzari, but it took place in the 8th century. The Khazar people lived on the shores of the Caspian Sea. And according to... Now, the story of the conversion of the Khazar people is, as far as we could tell, a true story. The details of the story are not known to us, but according to the legend, so the Khazar king had a dream in which he was told, your ways of thinking are pleasing to the Creator, but the way that you act is not. And this leads him to convene a meeting of the greatest religious leaders and philosophers at the time. So he invites a Christian thinker and a Muslim thinker and an Aristotelian philosopher, and he rejects their views. He notes that he doesn't initially invite a Jew, because why would anyone want to hear the position of a despised people? Then he thinks about it a little more when he realizes that the religions of Christianity and Islam are based off of the Torah, so it makes sense to go back to the source. And after this long debate, he rejects all the other views and converts along with much of his nation to Judaism. So the book known as the Kuzari is a rendition of what that debate or conversation might have looked like. The Kuzari doesn't say this is what actually, or Rabbi Yehuda Levi doesn't say this is what actually happened, but this is what it might have looked like. This is what might have happened. And over the course of this conversation, we'll see many of the most important aspects of Jewish thought being addressed in a very fascinating way. In terms of the book, the king is convinced as to the correctness of Judaism towards the beginning of the second book, as I said, and he converts. And it goes on for five books, until the Chaver is the one presenting the Jewish view, finally announces his departure for the Holy Land. So let's begin. So again, bottom of page 12. So Rabbi Yehuda Levi writes that the essence of our obligation to serve God is rooted in personal revelation, that Hashem spoke to us and commanded us to keep the Torah. So take a look over here. Ma shani chayav bo, v'chayavim bo kol kal Yisrael, asher hisbarer etzlam ha-ma'amad ha-hu, bir'os einehem. What is mechayav me to observe the Torah is the fact that we experienced revelation. V'achar kein ha-kabbalah ha-nimshecha shehi kemar ha-ayin. And then subsequently the Kabbalah, meaning to say the tradition that has been passed on, and is as valid as Mara Ha'ayin, something that we saw ourselves. Rav Sadia Gaon, I think, was the first to formulate the very famous argument that Judaism alone among the world's religions was founded on mass revelation, that all the other religions were founded on the prophecy of one person or a small group of people or the like, and the notion that the claim that the Torah is based off of something that all of you or your forefathers have witnessed is not something that you could possibly convince a large group of people is true if it wasn't true. No charlatan would get away with such a lie, which is why all the other religions are based off of simply the revelations of one person or the miracles witnessed by a small group of people and so on and so forth. And then the king asks him that, does this imply that only Jews who experience the revelation have to serve God? So you know what, because we want to get a lot done, I'm just going to read the English, since anyway it's in translation, and you have it here. This, page 12 on the bottom, this is not the best translation necessarily. I put it here because it's available on the internet for free. It's from the 1906 Hartwig Hirschfeld translation, but you have the Hebrew as well, which is, this Hebrew is from the Ibn Tibbon translation, and it's worth looking at both, obviously, assuming that you don't speak Arabic, if you want to get a better sense of what's being said. So the Khazar king asks, if so, then your belief is confined to yourself. The rabbi responds, yes, but any Gentile who joins us unconditionally shares our good fortune, without, however, being quite equal to us. This is, of course, a very controversial line. In other words, yes, you could be a ger, but even after you're mizgayer, you're not quite the same. If the law were binding on us only because God created us, all men would be equal, since he created them all. But the law, meaning the Torah, was given to us because he led us out of Egypt and remained attached to us because we are the segula mikol ha'amin, the am segula. So this is an important point. We know, of course, that the halachas geirim also say we were taken out of Egypt. We're all Elokei Avraham, Yitzchak, v'Yaakov. We'll try to understand what he means over here. But what he's saying basically is, look, all human beings are human beings. And if the basis of our avoda was the fact that we're human beings, then we would all be the same. But the basis of our avoda is because of Yetzias Mitzrayim and the fact that we're the Am HaNivchar. Now, the king, understandably, is very offended by this claim, and he says to him, Jew, I see you are regressing in your statements, and your words are poor after having been so pleasant. Ah, no Saint Tam Lufgam, it's not just the Aradea. So you were saying such good things, and now you're saying such foolish things. So the Chavah responds by justifying the distinction by looking at the hierarchy in the rest of the world. So in the world, there's a hierarchy. There's mineral, there's plants, there's animals, and then there's man on top. So the king agrees to that categorization. It's not quite 20 questions, but the same basic idea. People, place, right? So the king agrees. And then the chaver asks the king, is there anybody above man? And the king says, there's no such level. And then the chaver starts describing Moshe. So over here, we're going to continue. The rabbi, if we find a man who walks into fire without hurt, or abstains from food for some time without starving, on whose face a light shines that the eye cannot bear, who is never ill nor ages, until having reached his life's natural end, who dies spontaneously, just like a man retires to his couch to sleep on an appointed day and hour, equipped with the knowledge of what is hidden as to past and future, is such a degree not visibly distinguished from ordinary human beings? Right? Obviously, such a person that has all these faculties is above a normal human. So the king responds, this is indeed the divine and angelic decree. If it exists at all, it belongs to the province of the divine influence. What is divine influence? We'll look at Hebrew in a second. But not to the world, not to that of the intellectual, human, or natural world. Right? Take a look at the Hebrew. He says, Ve'ena b'cholka inyan ha-sichli ha-nafshi o ha-tiv'i, ki im b'cholka inyan ha-aloki. So the rabbi says, these are some of the characteristics of the undoubted prophet through whom God made himself manifest, and who also made known that there is a God who guides them as he wishes, according to their obedience or disobedience. He revealed this to the prophet, that which was hidden, and taught them how the world was created. In other words, what's he saying? That Moshe's Madrega is fundamentally different than the four previous Madregos. Again, meaning Domem, Tzomeach, Chai, Adam. Moshe was on a categorically different level. So the Chavar has established that a fifth level exists. And the fifth level is basically the level of a prophet. Now, the question is, how does that relate to his thesis that the Jewish people are different than the rest of mankind? The answer, it seems, and we'll see this point developed as we read on, is because the Jewish people, and only the Jewish people, are capable of nevuah. Now, while it's true that not every Jew actualizes this potential, every Jew whose ancestor experienced the revelation at Har Sinai inherits the potential for prophecy, and therefore, the Kuzari seems to be saying, is categorically different. So essentially what he's saying, seemingly, is that there's a fifth rung in the hierarchy of creation. There is mineral, plant, animal, human, and Jew. What distinguishes the Jew from everybody else? So he tells us it's this Inyan Eloki. Inyan Eloki is a hard word to translate. Sometimes it's called the divine influence, or divinity, or something like that. And it's very hard to define. Let's see if we could try to get a better understanding of it. But I think before we define Inyan Eloki, we have to consider a very basic question. And this is, I think, the central question that I had when reading the Kuzari and his topic, his discussion of these topics, which is, what does this mean for us in the post-prophetic world? Obviously, none of us are Nevi'im. So is the effect of the Inyan Eloki, which, like we said, is what distinguishes the Jewish people insofar as it allows for prophecy, is that still relevant for us? None of us are prophets. The Kuzari, remember, says, this too is a highly contentious issue, but the Kuzari is of the view that a convert, while he becomes fully Jewish, does not share that Inyan Eloki, and therefore cannot be a prophet. We'll see maybe next week that, or if we have time this week, many Rishonim disagree with this. The Rambam even felt a non-Jew could experience prophecy. He says that the reason why we reject Islam is not because of the impossibility of a non-Jew being a prophet, because it is possible. There's a discussion, a famous discussion in the Gemara about this towards the end of the first parak of Bava Basra, and which implies there that at least theoretically it could happen, though Moshe requests that it not happen. Again, if we have time at the end, we can go back to that question. But one way or the other, the Kuzari stresses that what makes us different is the Inyan Eloki, and the Inyan Eloki is what allows for prophecy, and that's what differentiates the Jew from the rest of mankind. And the question is, what does that mean nowadays? After all, if we live in a post-prophetic world, now of course we long for the return of prophecy, and the return of prophecy is something that we surely believe in, but how significant is this Inyan Eloki in our world? Right? What does it mean for us? Are we still different if there is no such difference? So that's, I think, the Ikar Chakira. If you want to put it this way, we could say, is the pshat that the Inyan Eloki is a expression of a broader phenomenon which relates to the idea that we can relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu spiritually. The Inyan Eloki reflects an ability to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and have a relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a way that someone who lacks the Inyan Eloki cannot have. Again, someone who lacks the Inyan Eloki, we'll see, the Kuzari says, they're capable of relating to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on a rational level and even doing great acts of piety. He thinks that you could be a chassid, you could be a chacham, even without the Inyan Eloki. Non-Jews are all capable of doing that. Inyan Eloki, though, allows for an additional aspect of a relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is still possible today, though it's not fully expressed today, because we don't really have Nivu any longer. Is that the pshat? So in that case, it's still very relevant today. Or no, the Kuzari seems to always stress prophecy in his discussions of Inyan Eloki, in which case, again, we won't say that it's of no value nowadays. There's still value, but it's not particularly relevant because Lamaisa, we don't have prophecy anymore. So theoretically, we could be prophets, and one day we hope that prophecy will be restored shortly. But fundamentally, it's practically at the very least, it's not particularly significant. So that's the chakira we need to ask. See, there's a lot of hands up already.
Is Bill Bilaam not a direct example, though, of prophecy?
Okay, Bilaam is an interesting question. What would the Kuzari do about Bilaam? There are actually a couple of things to say about that, without getting into too much details, because that's not, Nevuah isn't our topic. The Rambam, who actually, as we mentioned, allows for prophecy among non-Jews, argues that Bilaam was not true prophecy. The Rambam has a whole list, number of levels for prophecy. He was like pre-prophecy, a type of Ruach HaKodesh, but it wasn't actual prophecy. Rashi, for example, in the Perash Altar also says that even though Moshe Rabbeinu asks that Hashem not be Mashre Shechinah so al Umos HaOlam, and that request was granted according to Rashi, still Bilaam was not an counterexample because it wasn't given it was given Toch Mikra and Kari, and it wasn't real or the like. So it's an interesting question how the Kuzari would deal with Bilaam, but not for now. But the answer might be that what Bilaam experienced was not the type of prophecy that is associated with Inyan Eloki. Yes?
But wouldn't we really agree that any Jewish person, even before Bittul Hanevuah, who just was never a Navi, would still have that difference? Meaning, why?
That's the question. Well, that's the same version of the question. A Jew, even during the time of Nevuah, who never realized that possibility of Nevuah, right, who never actualized that potential, so is such a Jew actually different from everybody else or not? Right? When he tells us about the fifth category of creation, right? So he introduces it by saying, describing Moshe Rabbeinu. So let's assume Moshe Rabbeinu and all Nevi'im. So it's the fifth category, the Navi, and it happens to be that only Jews could be Nevi'im, in which case, again, absent Nevuah, it's not particularly meaningful, or is the fifth Madrega Jew, and even the Jew who doesn't actualize that potential for prophecy is still fundamentally and categorically different and enjoys a different quality of relationship with the Ribbono Shalom. That's our question.
But he's answering a question about Jews. So
but he's answering it by describing a Navi. Right, so that's the question. How has he answered the question, right? In other words, there's ambiguity here. You ask me, what makes a Jew special? And I tell you, let me describe a Navi. Great. And I'll also tell you that only a Jew could become a Navi. So I'm still left with a question, well, what about a Jew who isn't a Navi? Right? What did the Kuzari feel about that question? And again, that's a very fundamental question for us. Is Nevuah the most extreme example of a broader phenomenon, something that's relevant to all of us, or not? Right? So, from the paragraph that we saw so far, it's ambiguous, it's unclear. So that's what we're trying to figure out. I don't think there's going to be an absolutely clear-cut answer, it happens to be, and I think it's a very fundamental question, but let's see what we could figure out. So on the one hand, when the Kuzari stresses Inyan Eloki, he almost always focuses, if not always, on prophecy. On the other hand, you know, prophecy had long since vanished when the Kuzari was written, and it seems unlikely that the Inyan Eloki, you know, the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, thought the whole idea of Inyan Eloki is no longer relevant. Why is he talking so much about it? So on the one hand, the fact that he always associates it with prophecy supports a second option. On the other hand, the fact that he's discussing it in this context, 1,000 years since there was prophecy, shows that the first option seems to be more correct. However, you can rebuff that particular proof because Rabbi Yehuda Halevi describes the Jew in exile in this post-prophetic world outside of Eretz Yisrael in a very lowly state. In our next thing that we're about to see, this is from Mamar Beis, he compares the Jew in exile to the dried out bones of Yechezkel. So take a look, bottom of page 13. The context here, well, let's just read it. It is true that the source of wisdom, the Aseres HaDibros, rested in the ark, and the ark is analogous to the heart, but not the head. The Ten Commandments were broken down into 613 mitzvos, which is why the Sefer Torah was placed next to the Luchos. However, from there, two wisdoms emerged: the wisdom of the Torah and its sustainers, the Kohanim, which is interesting, right? Sistei Kohen Yishmeru Das. The goal of the Kohanim was primarily to be the Marbitze Torah, and the wisdom of the Nevi'im and its sustainers, the prophets. These two groups of people became the cognizant advisors who exhorted and reminded the nation. They then respect the head of the nation. So we have the Nevi'im and the Kohanim respecting the representing the head and the heart of the Jewish people. That is what the Chavir says. So the king responds, if so, then it would seem that today you are a body without a head and without a heart. We don't have Nevi'im any longer, and we don't have Kohanim in a sense that there's no who. The Kohanim don't in particular serve this purpose. The Khuzari responds with an incredible statement, the Chavir. What you say is true. Moreover, we have no real bones, right? Not only do we not have a head, nor a heart, but we don't even have bones, just scattered bones, akin to the dry bones that Yechezkel saw in his vision. Nevertheless, King of Khazars, these bones have some remnant of life in them, for they were once utensils for the head, heart, life force, spirit, and soul. They are therefore better than the intact bodies whose head, eyes, ears, and the remaining parts are made of stone and plaster. These bodies never had a spirit of life rest within them, nor is it possible that they ever will. Rather, they are forms that resemble man but are really not man. Imagine I were to ask you the following question. What is more lifelike? I show you a wax sculpture from Madame Tussauds Museum that looks perfect and like a dried out bone. So maybe you'd say, oh, this statue looks much more lifelike. From far away, surely it does. But the truth of the matter is that the opposite is true. The wax structure has nothing to do with life whatsoever. It never lived and never will live. The bone, at least one time lived, and maybe you could take its genetic component and make life from it again. So he says to the king of the Khazars, yeah, we're still better than you, but the truth of the matter is we are like dried out bones, right? We are a pathetic remnant of our once glorious past. We have hope for the future, true, but right now, in our current state, we're dried out bones. That's how we understood the nevuah of Yechezkel. Now, going back to our Chakira, so perhaps this does support the second theory. In other words, there isn't much left of that Inyan Eloki today, where we are. Our stature is so low. Remember we asked, if the Inyan Eloki is not relevant, so what does he keep on talking about it? But he's telling us that we're, in our current state of affairs, so far from what we once were. Now, again, The king does note that this pedigree allows us to maintain our distinction throughout the long and bitter exile. This is in paragraph Lamed Gimel. We're now on page 14, in the middle. This is true. It is inconceivable that any other nation would be able to retain its identity in exile without eventually being assimilated into its parent culture, and certainly not after such a long period of time, right? It's because of who you once were that you're able to retain your identity even in Galus. Look how many nations who arose and even after the Jewish nation have been lost to history without even a memory remaining, right? Moreover, the Khuzari says that because of our celebrated ancestry and our hopes for a brilliant future, we are still distinct in a certain way, but at the same time, what we are now is a bunch of dried out bones pining for redemption. So the question is there anything left of us that still exists? Anything special? So here the Khuzari, in paragraph Lamed Dalet, does introduce something that we still have, and that is mitzvos. So the Chavir writes, do not think that because I conceded to your earlier words, namely that we are like we lack our heart and a head, this means we are like a dead object. Rather, we are attached to the divinity by way of the laws that God placed between ourselves and him. There is Bris Milah, of which it said, V'haysa Brisi V'vsachem L'Bris Olam. There's Shabbos, which is Osi Beinu V'Neichem L'Doroseichem. In other words, he seems to be acknowledging over here that we continue to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu even in the post-prophetic world. In other words, not all is lost. Now, he doesn't develop that idea too much over here, but later in the Sefer, in Chelak Hei, he does return to the significance of mitzvah observance, and we have to read what he says very carefully and figure out how what he says in Chelak Hei relates to what he says in Chelak Aleph and Chelak Beis. Yes?
So I think Lamed and Lamed Dalet, they give us a very powerful answer. Powerful. So a Jew is born I wrote some notes down. Okay. So we're born with an innate divine aspect, right? But you can also be imbued with divine aspect, as we see by Har Sinai. So from generation to generation, it's like Gorera, it's stronger and stronger. And now God can choose to interface with an individual. It doesn't mean he's Ruach HaKodesh. So you look at Bilam, God chose to interface with Bilam. Now, you look at Lamed Dalet, he's talking about, you know, being attached to the divinity through Torah observance. That gives the convert was not born with an innate insuits, or Hashem gives him maybe a small one, but through his Torah observance, he has the ability to build it. So maybe his children will inherit a stronger insuits.
Well, let's see what he says about this.
So the answer in Lamed Dalet and Lamed.
Let's read a little more. There's a lot that he has to say. We're not going to see even all of it, but let's read on and see if your theory holds up. So, yes?
Why didn't you say before that we don't have a heart today? Like, Torah.
No, but the heart, but we don't have Nevi'im and we don't have Kohanim. Well, no, he's even focusing, it's an interesting point, but Kohanim in the role of Marbitzei Torah. You're saying, you know, V'lo Shevet Levi Bilvad. Right? What about the end of Hilchos Shemitah v'Yovel? So, it's a very interesting question. And we'll have to think a little bit more about it. But clearly, the Khuzari felt that what we have nowadays, though we certainly continue to study Torah, is not what once existed. And that's because of the association, like you're correctly saying, to the Avoda, the Beis HaMikdash, to Kohanim, the Beis HaMikdash, and that aspect of Avoda Hashem, which was rooted in the Mikdash and carried out through the Kohanim, we lack. Now, one way of taking this idea, though it doesn't quite seem like this is what the Khuzari is saying, is to say, we're going to take this idea of the Khuzari and say we still have that, and the connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which once existed through prophecy, exists through Talmud Torah, and that level of connection still exists, and many thinkers even take this idea and argue that Talmud Torah has advantages over Nevuah. Chacham is Adif Minavi, though it's not as directly coming from HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the same time, because it uses our own Seichel. It comes from within us, and while we might connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu differently in the post-prophetic world, we still have the ability to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a very, very profound way and the like. And that is a very powerful mahalich, a mahalich that many, many great Jewish thinkers have taken, and they sort of take Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's focus on prophecy and says, in our world, that's Talmud Torah and the like. However, that doesn't seem to be the mahalich of the Kuzari. The Kuzari is much more, it seems, both Mikdash and Nevuah focused. So a lot of times, and again, a very powerful mahalich is sort of to take the ideas of the Kuzari and reframe them a little bit. But again, the Kuzari himself doesn't seem to be saying that. He doesn't say, well, it's true, we don't have the Beis HaMikdash, but we still have vibrant Torah institutions whereby which we connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Torah and Tefillah and Mitzvos. He says, no, you're right, Mr. King, we're like dried out bones. But we are once alive, and we hope to be alive once again. But then, after having said that, then he does say, we continue to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Mitzvos. And the question is, what is that? How does that relate to his broader theme, right? What is the Kuzari saying? Because he doesn't say, well, no, because we can connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Mitzvos, we're not just like a dried out bone anymore. He concedes the point that we are like a body without a head and without a heart. But he still says that there is this connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Mitzvos. In other words, not all is lost. This is a broader question. What role do Mitzvos play in general and also in Galus? Right? Think of the famous Rashi and the comments of the Ramban about how Mitzvah observance in Chutz La'aretz is practice of some sort, but lacks the same inherent value as it did once in Eretz Yisrael. So this is a very important question, a broader question, and there are different mahalchim. We're going to try to understand what the Rebbe Yehuda Halevi thought about the topic. But again, it's not easy. It's not understanding his position is not so straightforward. Okay, let's continue. So again, now we're going to read from much later in the Sefer, from Chelak Hay, paragraph 20, which is on page 16, top of page 16. Where is this? No, sorry, bottom of page 14. Bottom of page 14. Turn that up to there. Bottom of page 14. So this is from Chelak Hay. The fourth principle for understanding and observing the Torah expresses the conviction that existing beings are of higher or lower degree. Everything that is possessed of feeling and perception is higher than those creatures which lack the same, since the former are nearer the degree of the prime cause, who himself is intellect. The lowest plant occupies a higher rank than the noblest mineral. The lowest animal is higher than the noblest plant. The lowest human being is higher than the noblest animal. So here we go back to the hierarchy that he described earlier. Likewise, the lowest follower of the Torah occupies a higher place than the noblest person among the Ovdei Avodah Zarah, who do not possess Torah. For the divine law confers something of the nature of angels on the human mind, a thing that cannot be acquired otherwise. So here he's telling us that through Shmiras HaMitzvos, we are transformed into a qualitatively different type of person than the person who does not observe mitzvos. The proof is that the prolonged practice of this law leads to the degree of Ruach HaKodesh, right, and Nevuah, Let's just read the Hebrew. It's a very important line. V'domo lezeh ha'pachos b'vnei adam mekaimei ha'mitzvos ha'eloka yizbarach madregaso lemala mizu shel alyonim b'mechusare mitzvah. It's a little different than that English we just read. Ki ha'mitzvah haba'a me'eis ha'eloka makneh l'nefashos hisnahagus malachim utchunasam. V'davar zeh Ein lehasigo b'shem derech kinyan acheres. Raya ledavar. Ha'asmada al ma'isei ha-mitzvah, ha-zos, mevia el dargas ha-nevua, shehi ha-krova shebimadregos enosh el hamala ha-elokis. Ba'al ha-mitzvos ha-chote, hu efo tov, mimichusar ha-mitzvah. Ki ha-mitzvah ha-elokis, kvar hiknesa lo, hisnagus Malachis, bo yisromeim el madregas ha-malachim. Again, we'll read the last sentence in English now. The proof is that prolonged practice of the law leads to a degree of prophetic inspiration, a observer of mitzvos that sins is greater than the one who lacks mitzvos because the divine law empowered him to lead an angelic life and to reach the degree of angels. And even if his sins sullied and defaced his stature, some traces always will remain, and the fire of his longing for it is not quite extinguished. If he had his own choice, he would not prefer to remain untutored, just as a sick and pain-plagued person would not prefer to be a horse, fish, or bird, which, though happy and free from pain, is far removed from reason that brings near to the divine decree. So here he seems to be telling us that a person who shomer mitzvos is fundamentally different, even though he lacks prophecy, than those that don't have mitzvos. And not only that, but it's not just about, it's not even if they're the perfect tzaddik, because even if they do averos, so what's his mashal? A Jew who does lots of averos is like a very sick person. So if you go to a very sick person and you tell such a person, what would you rather be? A very sick person or a healthy dog? Now, if you ask some people in the street, that they would probably tell you, I'd rather be a healthy dog. Or healthy bird flying around all over the place. But Yehuda Levi takes for granted that no reasonable person would say that. Right? Obviously, you'd rather be a healthy person than a sick person than a healthy dog. And the fact that mitzvos can bring a person to prophecy, even though they don't always do so, and in our world do not do so at all, says that, tells us that they're still very valuable. So here too, he seems to be referring to the fifth rung of creation, but he is not focusing on Nevuah, and note, and this is extremely important, in this whole section, he doesn't say anything about the Inyan Eloki. Now, what does that mean? So, this section does seem to be somewhat different than what he says earlier. I don't believe that there is a contradiction. There are some people who claim that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi basically changed his mahalach between what we saw earlier and what we're reading now. I don't think that there's a basis for that. I think over here, earlier, when he was talking about the Inyan Eloki, he was talking about the potential for prophecy, which is something that's latent and has to be realized if it's to be valuable insofar as achieving prophecy. And now he's talking about the fact that what Shmiras HaMitzvos have the ability to do. And specifically, if you have a person with that Inyan Eloki who observes mitzvos. So mitzvos can bring a person to prophecy, but are valuable in and of themselves, even if they don't. So these two discussions are linked. In both cases, he mentions prophecy. But here, because he's not focusing on the potential, but rather the actualization, so he does not focus on the Inyan Eloki. And I believe that's what he's getting at here. Now, we want to go earlier to add a very important point. Back in Chelek Aleph, towards later on from what we were reading before, in Chelek Aleph Kuf Tes Vav, he writes that, and that's in the middle of page 15, he writes that in discussing a ger, even someone who cannot become a prophet still has the ability to meaningfully connect to the Ribono Shel Olam. So take a look over here. If a non-Jew subscribes to the aforementioned discipline, right, so he observes mitzvos, he and his offspring will enjoy a large degree of closeness to God. Nevertheless, a convert still is not equal to the Jew who is born into the faith, because only a Jew can achieve prophecy. Converts can accomplish their purpose by accepting the word of God from the prophets and becoming wise and saintly. Right? They could be chachamim and chasidim, ach lo nevi'im. So, first of all, that mean, what does that mean for us? It means even in the post-prophetic world, we could all become chachamim and chasidim, even if we can't become nevi'im. What this might mean, and we're going to discuss this later, is that even non-Jews who lack the Inyan Eloki can become chachamim and chasidim, which is a pretty extraordinary thing. Right, I would be very excited to be a chacham and a chassid. And we should also note that Rabbi Yehuda Levi's view that a ger cannot is not the same even after gerus is something that's highly contentious. Even among those who accept that there is this fundamentally, metaphysically different quality of Jew and non-Jew, many of them, which the Kuzari is arguing for, many of them will agree that Gerim are capable of achieving this, either because during the process of Gerus they get a new type of neshama, or because, based off of the Gemara, that implies that the nefesh of Gerim were at Sinai, that the people that are destined to become Gerim were born with that special neshama. But that is the view of the Kuzari. Now, clearly though, the Kuzari also agrees that our connection is severely weakened, and even with our ability to do mitzvot, we're but a shadow of our former glory. Again, in Maimar Beis, he picks up on the idea that we're sick, that we're like dried out bones. He actually quotes over here, you have it towards the bottom of page 15, the prophecy that we read about last time, the suffering servant. He describes, he shows us, he follows the reading of most Rishonim, that the suffering servant is a Jewish people in exile, and he says, look at how the suffering servant is described. Look how sickly he is. He's not just sickly because everybody's beating him up. He's sickly because he's spiritually sick, right? And he describes that in the paragraph on the bottom of 15, but we're not going to read that now because I want to read on a little bit. So going back to our chakira, I think that the Rabbi Yehuda Levi's Mahalach is somewhere in between those two options we mentioned earlier. In the Galus, we do continue to connect to God through mitzvos, and our unique stature, he maintains, is not entirely obsolete. But he still maintains that we're but a shadow of our former glory, and though we long for days where we will be restored, we're not quite the same. His position is a little reminiscent of a fascinating Ramban. The Ramban in Parshas Vayechi talks about the Maisa Avosim and Labanim. All of Bereishis is Maisa Avosim and Labanim. What's the Maisa Avosim and Labanim of Yaakov dying in Mitzrayim? and then being brought back up to Eretz Yisrael dead. So his answer is, that's because Klal Yisrael is going to die in Galus, and we're going to be brought back to Eretz Yisrael dead. Now, obviously he means that we're not actually dead, right? We're alive, we're vibrant, we learn Torah, we connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but spiritually we're dead. And as great as we think things are nowadays, we don't have a clue, Ramban, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and others stress, as to what a human being can be and what a Jew could be. Ad kedei kach, that's the ma'aseh avos min labanim of Yaakov dying in Galus. Right? It's quite remarkable. Okay, what I want to do very quickly, we don't have time to go through this carefully, but it'll help us understand what this idea of Inyan Eloki that he's talking about much better, is to describe how it is that the Jewish people alone got the Inyan Eloki. So turn to the top of 16. And if in the previous section we've been describing what makes the Jewish people essentially different, here he talks about why they are unique and how it happened. So this is from 1 section 95. Adam was perfection itself, because no flaw could be found in a work of a wise and almighty creator, wrought from a substance chosen by him and fashioned according to his own design. And now basically he's going to say three factors that might inhibit a person from achieving their inherent potential, and why Adam HaRishon, as the direct connection of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, did not have those. So there's no restraining influence because of the seed of the father or the blood of the mother, right? Because he was created by God. Number two, no question of nutrition or education during the years of childhood and growth, right? He didn't have a bad chinuch or bad food or whatever it is. And finally, number three, neither was the influence of the climate, water, or soil to consider. He was in Gan Eden. For he's created in the form of an adult, perfect in body and mind. The living soul with which he was endowed was perfect. His intellect was the loftiest possible for a human being to possess. And beyond this, he was gifted with a divine power of such high rank that it brought him into connection with the divine beings and spiritual, and enabled him with slight reflection to comprehend the great truths without instruction. We call him Ben Elohim. Now, Adam was perfect in every way, right? That's what he's just told us. With respect to his soul, his intellect, and his divine influence. All humans possess those first two elements, their soul and their intellect. However, the third, the divine influence, is limited. Not all humans possess it. And we'll see that this Inyan Eloki is almost described in genetic terms. He's going to compare it actually to plants, as we've seen already. He compares it that way. And this quasi-genetic component, this Inyan Eloki, was not received by all of Adam HaRishon's children. In fact, he writes that it was this inferiority that incited Cain to kill Hevel. Adam left many children, of whom the only one capable of taking his place was Hevel, because he alone was like him. After he had been slain by Cain, through jealousy of this privilege, right? A fascinating take on the machlokas between Cain and Hevel. Cain was jealous that Hevel possessed this Inyan Eloki. So then it was passed on to Shase, who also, like Adam, v'chule, that essence was passed from Shase to Enosh, and it was possessed by isolated individuals down to Noach. They are compared to the seed, they resembled Adam, and were called sons of God. They were perfect in body and character, their lives, knowledge, and ability being likewise faultless. Their lives fixed the chronology from Adam to Noah. Right? That's what we talk about in Divrei HaYamim at the beginning. Now, this continued to go on, basically, until Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu inherited this Inyan Eloki and actualized this Inyan Eloki. And he passed it on to Yitzchak, who passed it on to Yaakov. Yaakov was the first to pass it on to all his children. And thus began a community in which everybody was in possession of this special spiritual quality. Now, even among Bnei Yisrael, not all the descendants proved righteous. Even the rotten branches, however, are spared because they can produce righteous fruits. Meaning to say, the Rasha in Bnei Yisrael can produce a tzaddik because that Inyan Eloki is passed on. Now again, these ideas are very similar to a lot of ideas you'll see in Kabbalah. It uses very different types of terminology. Now, the parable of the seed, which he's using throughout, sharpens the difference, right? What's the significance of the seed? You have a fruit, you have a shell, let's say in a nut, and you have the seed. And the seed is significant because it can pass on those genes, that potential, to the next generation, even if it was never actualized itself. But it can be a means to pass it on. Right? You might have a prize seed, and that doesn't necessarily produce beautiful fruit. Why? Because let's say it didn't have the proper environment, right? It wasn't nourished, it wasn't watered properly. You have a great seed, an amazing seed. But you don't water it enough, it doesn't get enough sunlight, it produces very shvacha fruits. But it could pass on that potential to the next generation. And its offspring can produce, once again, beautiful fruits. Those are the environmental factors that we saw he was describing earlier. And that basically, that realization took place in the form of the Avos, that's what he's saying, who received this aspect which came down to them from Adam. It wasn't necessarily actualized fully in anybody from Adam to Avram Avinu. It was to some degree and to varying degrees in the different people. And Adam HaRishon actualized it. Now then, he writes, that basically everything changes after Yaakov Avinu. Because after Yaakov Avinu, as opposed to Avram, where some of his children had this and some didn't, and same with Yitzchak, with Yaakov it was everybody. Now again, it doesn't mean that everybody was great. It doesn't mean that every Jew is great. But every Jew has this potential for greatness. And that's how he explains it. Again, read the text on the bottom of 17 going on to 18. We can't read it together now. So basically, though, what he's saying is that before Yaakov, certain factors, things like education, climate, free will, prevented the Inyan Eloki from being passed down to subsequent generations. But after Yaakov, it didn't. Now, when you read a lot of these paragraphs, you come up with a very false impression, which is, it sounds like it's all genetic. But that's also not true, because it forgets about a very important thing, which is Bechira Chafshis. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi spends a lot of time stressing and emphasizing Bechira Chafshis. In section 5, paragraph 20, he writes that anybody who denies Bechira is a perverse hypocrite. And ultimately, success, even if you inherit this potential, is dependent entirely upon free will. And we're only rewarded for that which we choose freely. So there is this genetic component, but there's also this aspect of freedom. In section 317, which you have on page 18, he describes why it was that the Jewish people merited revelation and why they alone were zocha to perpetually have this Inyan Eloki, Ayin Shem. We don't have time. Page 18, we have a very interesting discussion of why there is a need for the hierarchy. The king basically asks, why is this division necessary? Wouldn't it have better, it would have been better for everybody to sort of, every human being to have this potential, and then those who realize this potential will be great, and those who don't, won't. Right? Why do you need these two factors? Freedom plus heredity. He gives an interesting answer. He says, well, would you rather everybody be humans? Like, what's the point of there being animals and plants and the like? You need different types of things in the Bria. And therefore, a hierarchy is necessary. The Rambam actually says a very similar thing when asked the same question. Right? So he says, just like you can't ask, why did you not create me as an angel? So it doesn't make sense to ask that question. Now, in that section, and in a number of places, we actually saw one a couple of weeks ago, the Kuzari, though he does describe the Jewish people alone as having this Inyan Eloki, also stresses that non-Jews also can achieve a high level of perfection in a certain way. Okay, now we have to stop in the middle. But I urge you to read all of Sefer HaKuzari for next week, so that way you'll have a much better understanding of what he's talking about. I just want to conclude with a couple of points. Obviously, the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, was a Rishon and a thinker that plays a very important role in our understanding of the Torah. At the same time, many of the things he says, he has said, as we saw, have been debated. And his view isn't universal. And what we're going to talk about next week, Be'ezras Hashem, is whether everyone agrees to this idea that there is the inherent spiritual or metaphysical difference between Jew and non-Jew. We're going to specifically focus on the position of the Rambam. But it is important to remember that, again, even Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, though he does clearly have this very significant, at least theoretical difference, again, whether it's theoretical or practical today is a question we just discussed, but this difference, he also does allow for a significant spiritual possibility even from non-Jews. Okay, so we'll stop here. There's a lot more to say about the Kuzari, but I guess you'll have to figure that out on your own. Okay, have a good Shabbos, and that's it, and we'll pick up next week.